It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
News Podcast presents Bret Baier's All-Star Panel.
America's got to be in the lead if you want to deal with these threats. We're going to lead.
The morning is over. The Shiva is done. And if you're a conservative, you should be optimistic.
You know, my main priority right now is making sure that it delivers for the American people.
We have to make our country great again, and I will do that.
I think the president gets criticized by people all the time for the stuff he says, by people who ignore what he does.
Now, Fox's chief political anchor, Bret Baier.
A cargo ship exiting the port of Baltimore lost power early Tuesday morning, causing the Francis Scott Key Bridge to collapse after it was hit, multiple people falling into the freezing waters. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is in Baltimore to assess the damage and work with local authorities on the potential commuter disruptions, as well as the impact on one of the busiest ports in the United States. President Biden spoke from the Roosevelt Room Tuesday afternoon.
Around 850,000 vehicles go through that port every single year, and we're going to get it up and running again as soon as possible. 15,000 jobs depend on that port, and we're going to do everything we can to protect those jobs and help those workers. The bridge is also critical for travel, not just for Baltimore, but for the Northeast Corridor. Over 30,000 vehicles cross the Francis Scott Key Bridge on a daily basis. It's virtually it's one of the most important elements for the economy in the Northeast.
Meanwhile, there are concerns over the U.S.'s rocky relationship with Israel after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu abruptly canceled a delegation meeting at the White House. This decision comes after the U.S. abstained from vetoing a U.N. Security Council proposal that called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, allowing the resolution to pass, becoming the first ceasefire resolution to pass the U.N. Security Council since the war began. However, the White House is, quote, perplexed by Bibi Netanyahu's decision. To discuss this and more, we bring in our panel, Chief Political Correspondent at the Washington Examiner, Byron York, former Tennessee Congressman, co-host of The Five, Harold Ford Jr., and host of the Ben Domenech podcast, Ben Domenech. Okay, Harold, the breaking news this afternoon is on the political front, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Choosing Ms. Shanahan to be his vice presidential pick. It is a pick that had largely been thought to come around. She is a big donor for RFK Jr., and he is now poised to get on a number of different ballots, saying that if he could get on all of the ballots, that he thinks he has a chance. What is your thought about this VP pick and how RFK Jr. is going to factor into this general election?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I think a few things. RFK Jr., first, my prayers go out to everyone in Baltimore that waking up to that news, I'm sure all of us and every American had to be concerned and worried and grieving for those who've lost loved ones. So our prayers there. RFK Jr.'s campaign, I think, has always been a cause for concern for Democrats. And I think it is even more so today when you think about and you consider the polling, our polling, as well as other outlets that show that when he's in the race in the battleground states, Mr. Biden loses by more points. I think Mr. Biden got some encouraging news over the last few polls in some of the battleground states showing that he was inching upwards, but still not ahead of Mr. Trump. Mr. Kennedy's campaign is an interesting one to me because he seems to be drawing. At one point, we thought he might draw from only Biden supporters. And at one point, it looked as if he might be pulling from some of the Trump supporters as well. I think as the race settles and the race really settles is the wrong word. As the race begins to form more and issues become more important and the candidates actually take firm positions and we hear it from their mouths, I think we'll see even more of the impact that Mr. Kennedy will have. What's curious to me, Brett, is whether or not Mr. Kennedy will be allowed in any of the debates. And if you look at some of the traditional debate formats, he's likely not to qualify. But, you know, this has been such an unusual political season. Does he find his way into a debate between the two major party candidates? Or does he just find himself in a debate with one of those candidates? I think either way, it helps Kennedy, who has huge name recognition for all the obvious reasons that the enormous political dynasty that he comes from, probably the most famous our nation has ever produced. And where he comes down on some of these critical issues, foreign policy, and some of the, which I believe, I know foreign policy issues don't populate the top of people's minds in these presidential races. I think this is going to be one. I'm 53, where you're going to see foreign policy because of obviously what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in Ukraine, and obviously what's happening at the southern border to be maybe equal or rival the economy as the number one issue on many, many voters' minds, particularly the independent voters in those battleground states.
You know, Byron, Nicole Shanahan is the running mate. She's 38. She was previously married to the Google co-founder, Sergey Brin. Not to say that VP candidates overall make a big deal. She has been a supporter of RFK Jr. Financially before. In fact, paid for that controversial Super Bowl ad that got a lot of eyebrow raise from the Kennedy family. How do you see this ticket? And does it take more from the Biden team or the Trump team?
Well, I've always thought that RFK Jr. is going to take more from Biden than from Trump because he's a Democrat, RFK Jr. is. He is a Kennedy Democrat. And if you look at his ads, including the one that you just mentioned, they harken back to his uncle, John F. Kennedy, and his father, Robert F. Kennedy. As far as Nicole Shanahan, can somebody tell me why she should be a candidate for vice president? I mean, Kennedy himself has never held public office. And in conventional political wisdom, and I know this is not a conventional time, you know, maybe you pick somebody who's been in political office to give you some governmental experience on the ticket. And if you look at the last two vice presidents, you can go back well before that. But, you know, Mike Pence had been a governor and a member of the House of Representatives. Kamala Harris had been the Attorney General of California and then a U.S. Senator. I mean, these are super qualified people compared to Nicole Shanahan. And, you know, people are saying it's because she's rich.
He says he wanted a partner who is a young person. She's 38 years old, wants Nicole to be a champion of millennials and Gen Z Americans. She is a tech lawyer. She's also the daughter of immigrants who fought, he says, to make their way. So he did his introduction this afternoon.
So I'm still asking the same question, though.
Right.
So I what can I say? It's a very unusual candidacy. And obviously, we've been talking about Aaron Rodgers and Jesse Ventura before. So what am I saying? I mean, it was going to be an unusual choice.
Yeah. Ben, last word on this. It's mm-hmm. not somebody that we know, obviously.
Yeah.
It is an interesting bumper sticker. If you're Irish Catholic, I think Kennedy Shanahan raises some looks at it, but I don't know how, if he gets Ross Perot numbers, you know, 19%, that's going to change things.
I did go back this past week, in fact, to dig up the old Admiral Stockdale bit that Dennis Miller.
Who am I?
So, why am I here? Here's the thing about this. First off, I don't think it changes anything fundamentally, but I do think it's an indication, a head nod in the direction of what both Byron and Harold said, in the sense of saying my interest is in appealing to disaffected younger Democrats. In other words, people who are tired of Joe Biden because he's too old. They think he's too out of touch. They maybe have different attitudes about a number of different things. From my perspective, the pull that he was always going to take away from on the right side of the aisle was the kind of libertarian-ish Trump critic, people who still resent Trump for instance, listening to Anthony Fauci and the health bureaucratic establishment during COVID. And I think that that number of people, while it's not nobody, is a very small sliver by comparison to younger Democrats who are as I said, you know, frustrated with Joe Biden and his administration for any number of reasons. The irony, though, of this is that RFK really, if he was going for that gung-ho, he would be taking a different stance on Israel than he has, which is where he's been clearly, you know, much more hawkish than the Biden administration on a number of different counts in his public statements. I don't think that this choice matters all that much, but I do think it's a head nod toward the fact that he understands that's where his avenue of having an impact on this cycle really is. And Harold, gosh, I hope we get some debates. It would really be nice to get some debates this cycle. I'm not sure that's going to happen. So he may end up being on stage, debating other people who are running in the independent lane. But I have a hard time seeing him making it to the big stage. But again, we've seen in the past how much just a few thousand votes in, you know, Florida in 2000 can change things around. And RFK, it looks like, is on track to not just be on the ballot in a state like Utah, but also a state like Arizona. They say that he's gotten enough to get on the ballot in Georgia. He's gunning for Michigan as well. So we could have a situation where he ends up being a major factor in terms of the count.
Yeah, and if he teamed up with Libertarians, he could get on a whole bunch of ballots, but we'll see where that goes.
They're on 36, 37 ballots already, and so that's right. Also a possibility.
Panel, we'll hold it right there.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Harold, Ben mentions Israel policy, and this week really has tested that tension between the U.S. and Israel. Clearly, the Biden administration, the Netanyahu administration don't see eye to eye on some things. And increasingly in recent weeks, the Biden administration has been pretty forceful saying what you can't do to the Israelis. This abstention of the U.N. Security Council resolution in Israel was read as a change in U.S. policy, and hence they pulled back those senior aides. How do you see it, and how does it play politically?
So it really speaks to, we the three of us have, and you, Brett, too, with the questioning, the unusual kind of unconventional moment we find ourselves in politics. I don't recall a time where America and Israel were not lockstep on issues that, or an issue that would impact or potentially impact the security of Israel and the Middle East, for that matter, and the broader world. But this is one of those moments. I think that, the other thing that's unusual about it is that this is the first time that the two leading presidential candidates for both parties, in this instance, are in agreement. It appears, at least what I've read from President Trump, former President Trump, he's in agreement in large part with where he's not articulated or enumerated as fully as President Biden's team has, but they seem to be more aligned with one another than they are on any other issue that's major in this campaign. This is something that has to find, when I say it, our foreign policy has got to get aligned with Israeli foreign policy and vice versa. That doesn't mean that we have to agree with everything that they're saying or everything that they want to do. But I don't think we have been as far apart or as far apart as some in the Israeli war cabinet and some in the Netanyahu war cabinet suggest. This administration believes that the hostages should be released. Where they are to disagreement is about what happens in Rafah. And forgive me if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly.
No, that's right.
And I have to think at some point we're not going to relent. And we being the United States, and this administration is not going to relent. And as long as President Trump maintains his position, Brett, I don't know where the room is for difference. We've seen Republicans in the House and the Senate be unwilling to face President Trump on issues that they agree or disagree with him on, as long as wherever his position is their position. So that tradition will be tested here shortly.
I don't know, Harold. Schumer's speech on the floor seemed like a demarcation point, where Democrats felt like they were spreading their wings a little bit and pushing back on Netanyahu's administration specifically, Israeli policy, you know, broadly, and how they were doing things. Now, whether they were doing that politically to shore up places like Michigan and the Arab American vote, you can speculate. But it seemed like that point at which the administration started taking more and more aggressive statements, making them, and then abstaining on a UN Security Council veto is really, I mean, it's kind of a big move. The resolution itself doesn't mention Hamas once. It doesn't link the release of hostages with the ceasefire in the resolution itself, the text. And Israel took it as pretty much in your face.
So, Brett, my only point, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I'm only saying President Trump, in his words and his remarks in the last 24 hours, seems to agree with the Biden administration and seems to agree with the resolution. But so my larger point is, where do you go if you if you're Israel, if the two leading candidates for president are suggesting what they're suggesting, and even the third party candidate, and RFK Jr. is even perhaps more even stronger position than the Israelis believe, or negative position that the Israelis believe the Biden administration has taken. That's my only point about where do you go.
Yeah.
Now, where do you go politically? I don't disagree with anything you said. Schumer's speech was certainly one of the most powerful speeches, and certainly the most powerful speech you've heard from the leading Jewish American politician in the country against the Israeli political situation. He wasn't saying it was for Hamas. He just speaks to Netanyahu. They had to call elections, and there's probably a good chance, Brett, if they called elections today, that Mr. Netanyahu would not prevail. And if he would prevail, if I were him, I'd call the elections just to show the Americans that you're wrong and that the Israelis are lined up behind me.
So right, but Byron, I guess
the moment is odd for that reason, because unanimity between these two candidates on this issue is striking.
I guess, Byron, I don't know whether the administration overplayed its hand in this way. You know, if you have even elections in Israel, will the other side, if they won, also see it as a slight that the U.S. abstained from vetoing this resolution that really essentially called for a sustained ceasefire without any action on Hamas and didn't put the onus on Hamas for holding these hostages or creating this environment?
I think that's a great point, and I think they would. And I think what you've seen, first of all, you have to just understand or take note of the politics in the Democratic Party right now, in which there's so many voters who are trending pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli in this conflict, and White House having to deal with that. Then I agree with you also that Senator Schumer's speech was a big landmark. And I think kind of underlying this is this belief. I mean, the United States has long given a lot of military aid to Israel. We give about $4 billion a year. Most of that, Israel is required to turn around and buy weapons from United States companies or military services from United States companies. And I do think this creates this relationship when you've given aid to a country for a lot of years that you can kind of tell them what to do. And I just have this sense, watching the Democratic leadership, that they're frustrated when they start off by very diplomatically hinting and nudging, and now they're just basically trying to tell Israel what to do, and Israel's not doing it because they feel that they have greater priorities in destroying Hamas. So I think the underlying relationship is a big. Big thing that's being tested in this whole conflict right now.
And yesterday, you know, when Vice President Harris said, it was asked, will there be consequences if Israel goes into Rafah? And she said, I'm not taking anything off the table. We're not taking anything off the table. In other words, consequences against Israel. At which point, and I mentioned this last night on the show, Ben, Democratic Senator Fetterman from Pennsylvania tweeted, on X, that's a hard no. You can't push back on Israel for defending itself and going after Hamas. Fetterman is proving to be one of the most pro-Israel Democrats, definitely in the Senate.
Yes, and certainly one of the more interesting members of a body that lacks a lot of interesting members at the moment, I would say. The thing that sticks out to me about this, and it's been true, I think, for quite some time, is that it's very foolish for those who push on this to view the entire lens of their problem through Bibi Netanyahu. It's not as if in the absence of Netanyahu, you would see some type of vast shift in priority or strategy. I think that there would be shifts, obviously, but he's not just, it's not just that it comes all down to him. And I think that that's a huge mistake that has been made time and again when it comes to the perception that people have of these priorities. Israel's priorities is at this moment is the destruction of Hamas. They refuse to be paralyzed by the different the chains that are being put around them by the Biden administration. They're pushing back against them. They're making clear that they are committed to that goal. And I think that that's going to continue to put people like John Kirby in a tough position where they have to spin some of these decisions, even knowing what they know about the way that this is playing out and how much this is driven by, I think, the politics of personality, the longtime tension between Joe Biden and Bibi Netanyahu, as opposed to an understanding of the priorities of our best ally in the Middle East.
Hey, Ben, can I ask a question? How do you reconcile then what President Trump is saying about Israel and what President Biden is saying? I don't disagree with anything you've said about the release of the hostages. I think Senator Fetterman has become a towering voice. What a difference a year makes and how he is perceived by everyone. Where I would differ with you guys, I think the new administration in Israel would be different than what some are suggesting, but that's another Brett panel.
I'll just note that this week also had coverage of President Trump's comments over the weekend that said that any Jew who votes for Democrats is going against their religion because Democrats currently hate Israel. So it doesn't really match up with lining up with the Biden administration policy, because he got hammered for that. And, you know, rightly so, he raised a lot of eyebrows with that comment, Ben. But to Harold's question, the difference between policy between the Biden administration and what Trump is saying now when it comes to vis-a-vis Israel.
Well, I think that Trump's comments are, very much in the mold of someone who's just trying to hit his opponent from all sides. I don't see it as being a particularly coherent policy message when it comes to what he believes Israel ought to do. It's all about kind of positioning, and we've seen him do that in the past. When it comes to any of his political foes, he just kind of dances around and uses the luxury of being out of power to critique from all sides and say that he would have done it better. I think that, you know, faced with the situation as it is right now, I think he, you know, if he was in office, I think he would be much more likely to let Israel loose to do whatever they needed to do and not be as much of a critic. But I do think that, you know, that's something that I would love to hear debated on a presidential debate stage. We didn't get a foreign policy debate last time around. Would be really nice to have one this time around.
I agree.
To see the differences between them.
All right, Byron, circling back to where we began, RFK Jr. wrapping up his speech says, quote, "Our campaign is a spoiler." I agree with that. It's a spoiler for President Biden and President Trump. Question is, where does he go from here? And does the allegation that the Biden campaign is trying desperately to keep him off ballots and working against him, you know, behind the scenes, does that somehow reverberate politically?
Well, this is a race where there's definitely room for a spoiler. And his candidacy is made for all of those polling numbers that we have seen and discussed, which show so many Americans, a majority of Americans, unhappy with having to make a choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. So, I mean, if ever there were a third-party opportunity in our lifetime, it seems like this would be it. I'm not saying RFK Jr. is the perfect vessel for that, but that is where he is. And I think the fact that Biden is trying so hard and the Democratic National Committee are trying so hard to keep him off the ballots. And we have to remember that he's apparently officially only on one ballot, Utah, right now. But the fact they're trying so hard to keep him off the ballot shows that they think it's a big threat. The conditions are perfect for a third-party candidate. Not saying one would win, but one could do well.
Yeah, and no labels apparently is swing and a miss on their candidacy, but we'll see what develops there. Panel, right. Thanks so much. Now a bit of history. In late March of 1775, Patriot Patrick Henry demanded, "Give me liberty or give me death." With this now iconic phrase, the revolutionary firebrand was attempting to rally his fellow Virginia leaders to raise troops and battle the British. In the end, his persuasion proved successful, as just 4 weeks later, the battles of Lexington and Concord would begin in Massachusetts, marking the beginning of the American Revolution. That'll do it for this week. You can hear more of this series at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. Make sure to leave a rating and a review. We want to hear from you. For Byron, Harold, and Ben, I'm Brett Baer. We'll see you next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.